You know, your deepest thoughts, even the ones of the unconscious, do come through because you're not sort of completely in control anymore. You just have to present something that, in a sense, you know, you think about a sportsman as well. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, right? Even though they had worked for hours and hours for that and they'd repeated the same move or the same exercise for the same routine for a lot of times. However, that's the fascinating aspect about performing, is that one should also be able to sort of double themselves and have this sort of overlook from above while performing, in the sense of anticipating what's coming next, in the sense of always remembering yourself to breathe, to feel as grounded as possible, to find your center of gravity. What I have to say, though, I think my gut feeling has followed me, or at least my gut feeling told me if something extraordinary was going to happen, my gut feeling would tell me that. Let's take even the Tchaikovsky competition. I was incredibly nervous for the whole sort of half a year preparation before going there. But also that's probably because my gut told me that something special was going to happen.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about guts. And today, we'll talk about music and the profound impact of the cello, an instrument that can reveal the divine essence and existential depth of music when played from the gut. And guess with whom we'll be talking.
Our guest today is the prestigious Romanian cellist Andrei Ioniță. After studying with Anne-Marie Palladi and later with Professor Jens-Peter Mainz at the University of the Arts in Berlin, he burst onto the international music scene with his first prize at the prestigious International Tchaikovsky Competition in 2015. Since then, the winner of the AID, Kachaturian and Feuermann competitions has become an acclaimed soloist, appearing with major orchestras, including the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Gewandhausorchester Leipzig, German Symphony Orchestra, DSO, Munich Philharmonic, Tornhalle Orchestra, Zurich, London Philharmonic Orchestra and the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra. Described by the Times of London as one of the most exciting cellists to emerge in a decade, Andrei Ioniță is a remarkable artist known for his technical brilliance and profound musicality, whose performances with conductors of great stature like Herbert Blomstedt, Paavo Järvi, Kent Nagano, Susanna Mielke, Christian Macellaru, and Ruth Reinhardt have earned him respect and the admiration of the classical music world. Appointed artist in residence with the Hamburg Symphony Orchestra in 2019, his first solo CD, Oblique Strategies, by Brett Dean, is a testament to his deeply emotional and intellectually engaging playing, as well as the immense range of timbres, registers, and techniques that the cello presents. But Andrei's journey isn't just about accolades and performances. It's about a deep connection to his instrument and a relentless pursuit of artistic excellence. Andrei brings a unique voice and a heartfelt sincerity to every note. Or rather, he plays music from the gut.
What a fantastic introduction. Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations, performed by the Munich Philharmonic and our guest, Andrei Ioniță. Andrei, welcome.
Hi, Ceci, thank you very much for having me.
Andrei, What an exciting year ahead of you, soloist guest at the BBC in London with a residency. You're invited to the Schleswig-Holstein Music Festival, the Utah Chamber Music Festival, the Intonations Festival, and so on. And I want to tell you about the first time I've heard your album, Oblique Strategies. So I lay down and started listening. And I got to Bretstein's part, the first of the compositions that we're listening right now. Suddenly, I envisioned myself on a search, as if I were in the middle of a forest, but not lost. No, it was a search for self-reflection, where I was able to hear the music produced by the cello, as if it were a game of hide-and-seek, a space where I felt how solitude and silence were transformed into music. And I would like to ask you, in addition to winning the Feuermann competition for which Bretstein composed and assembled these 11 short pieces for solo cello, what was so inspiring about them that you not only included them on your first solo album, but named the album after them, and most importantly, I have already told you about the forest that I imagined. But what about you? What is the imaginary that these short pieces evoke in you?
I basically wanted to showcase with my very first, say, so to speak, solo debut disc, just this wonderful instrument that you just described so wonderfully. I have to say I fell in love with the cello from the very first moment I sort of set my eyes on it during my first lesson. And its range of colors, its ambitus, it's just, you know, as many people say, it sounds like a cliche, but it is true. It is indeed the closest to a human voice. So what I wanted to showcase in my, you know, sort of debut CD was just the beauty of this instrument, which is why I first of all put together sort of two big masterpieces of the old and of the new, the Bach First Solo Suite and then the Kodály Cello Sonata, which is sort of this monstrous, ultra-virtuosic piece. And sort of like a thread to connect those two works. I wanted this sort of introspective, but also quite groovy work. And it was a very interesting process to actually learn this piece during the competition that you were mentioning. It was not the only commission work that I had to do during international competitions, but from all of those commission works that I have done, I always kept this particular work in mind. And just some sort of gut feeling told me that you have to put it out and you have to show it to the world. It's a collection of effects. It's a collection of different sounds that I even had to learn. I had to learn new techniques on the instrument, all sorts of battutos and harmonics and flageolets. And basically every short piece is sort of this sort of small universe, be it a forest, be it a room filled with mirrors, or just something very earthly or very grounded. It was just a fascinating work to discover, and it really worked very well in the setting of the whole recording, and it was just the best addition that eventually became the centerpiece of the CD.
Andre, you talked about the beauty of the cello and a bit about its colors. I want to ask you in depth, what is it about the cello that appeals to you? Is it perhaps its ability to mimic the subtleties of human emotion, which often passed unnoticed? Or what is it?
To me, first and foremost, it is the beauty of the sound. It is the warmth of the sound. Never in my life have I really heard an instrument produce really this sort of guttural form of expression. And maybe it was also meant to be. I just felt connected, as I said before, I just felt connected to the instrument from the very first moment. I did start with the piano when I was 5. And it was the proposal, or shall I say, actually the inspiration of my piano teacher back in Bucharest, my music school, to also studying a string instrument. The interesting thing is that we kind of decided a bit later on this. I was already in my 3rd grade. around 8-9 years old, which would have maybe been a bit of a late start for the violin, because if I were to catch up on the repertoire of other kids, it would have been, of course, frustrating. And for cello, you need anyway a bit bigger hands, or at least more flexible hands, well-developed hands, just because the instrument is bigger, you have sort of bigger distances to cover. Yeah, it was just this match made in heaven, I assume. I still kept on practicing piano as much as I could. So in a sense, I'm still a frustrated pianist at heart. But I do identify as a cellist, and this instrument just became the means of my expression. I don't think there's another even string instrument that is able to produce this sort of beautiful vibrato. The tone range is one of the biggest actually imaginable. And, you know, if listeners ever catch up to the CD that we were just mentioning, they are going to notice, especially in the Grattin work, as well as in the Kodai Sonata, really the range of colors and effects and everything wonderful about music making that this instrument can express.
Talking about matches made in heaven, Johann Sebastian Bach's music reflects man's irrational nature. And at the same time, its essence in its richness and complexity and mysteriously carries this nature beyond reason, uniting mind and soul, spirit and body. And I mean, Beethoven even compared his music to the vastness of the sea. The master said of the master, he, Johann Sebastian Bach, should not be called stream, meaning brook in German Bach, but sea, because of his infinite, inexhaustible wealth of tone combinations and harmonies. Also, it is said that of all instruments, the human voice is the most frequently used. And Bach's suites of unaccompanied cello have often been described as if the instrument itself were speaking, the music sounding as it had been written by the cello itself. And I'd love to hear about your experience of playing Bach's work, both for yourself and for the audience. As you've grown up professionally, has this experience changed, or better said, evolved at all? And if yes, in what way?
Well, yes, Bach's last name does mean a small river. However, I would actually associate him with the sky and with the heavens. Bach really is regarded as sort of the voice of the divine translated into earthly notes. And anytime one gets either to listen or to perform his music, you really feel this connection to a higher power and to something that's actually deeply transcendental. You were mentioning Beethoven. Beethoven probably is one of the most grand, or shall I say, earthly composers, in the sense of he kind of really expressed sort of the basic human emotions, whereas with Bach, he was sort of a messenger sent from above to communicate with us about divine ideas and feelings. Bach's music, it's so incredibly intelligently written. The structure is actually always very clear, even though it's very complex. He was indeed a mathematician. Nonetheless, some of his phrases are sometimes even reminding of actually romantic music, if you think about some music of his oratorios. These cello suites are quite an interesting subject within his big repertoire. They do feel a bit more subdued because, of course, you only have one solo unaccompanied instrument. However, even in that music, you can notice lots of polyphonies. Bach's music is always very bass-driven. You think just about, for example, the prelude in the fifth suite, which includes this amazing fugato that I doubt any other composer had ever written until that time for the cello. Mind you, the cello was still sort of a new instrument at that time. The most commonly used instrument for the lower register at the time was the viola da gamba. I mean, the first sort of works where, you know, you have even the title stipulated that it's written for violoncello, trace back to, I think, not more than 100 years before Bach even wrote these works. He probably sort of an experiment of exploring the range of this instrument. However, they're genius works. And we're also grateful to Pablo Casals, who rediscovered them 100 years ago and repopularized them. Every suite is sort of a small universe, and the one is maybe a bit more somber, the other one is more solar. And together they just create this wonderful narrative thread. It is really difficult to perform, let's say, the whole cycle of the six suites in a concert, which I have done and which has been a dream of mine for a long time. It does require a lot of mental strength, a lot of physical strength. However, just bringing the people together for 3 hours straight just to listen to this amazing music is an absolute transcendental experience, and I do recommend it to everybody.
Andre, we talked about how magical this instrument is and how it connects us and how it can move from the earthly to the divine. In a previous episode, I spoke with historian Elsa Richardson about the emotions originated in the gut, such as fear, love, heartbreak, foreboding, and even dreams. Let's hear what she has to say.
Emotions and how we understand, you know, the sight of emotions have long been mapped onto the body and onto different bodily, two distinct regions, the head and the heart, being associated with those higher feelings, courage, honor, brotherliness. And then you have the lower organs, namely the gut, especially also the liver, which were seen to produce baser appetites and desires, with feelings which are absolutely, with passions rather, perhaps is a better way of putting it, that have to be kept in check by the head and by the heart. Certainly there is an interesting history around creativity, inspiration, and the idea of gut feeling. The idea that some kind of bodily intuition was essential to the production of good art. There was some kind of sense of like, creativity as something that is embodied and that's something that sits outside of rationality, right? That's something that kind of escapes. You know, I think there's this way in which we now think about the gut and maybe gut feelings, right? Like to feel something in your gut is to feel an emotion most authentically. However, thinking about, let's say, the 17th and into the 18th century, there's also quite a lot of suspicion leveled at the gut and suspicion leveled at the way in which the gut might not always be an aid to creativity, but might sometimes be an impediment, right? That the gut and the mind are somehow kind of two systems of the body that can't work in harmony with one another. What is fascinating to me about the connection between the gut, the troubled gut, and dreams, and the dream and the nightmare, is that it brings to light the way in which psychological, supernatural, natural understandings of the brain and the belly are not always completely distinguishable from one another, right? That they often kind of can coexist alongside, right? This kind of, to be human is to be strung out across, you know, two sides of a belly. Where the outside world whistles in, how the outside world gets in to the kind of inner sanctum of the body.
In this respect, Andre, the cello's able to drag us from instinct to the divine as well, and you really know how to play from the gut. At what age did you feel this intimate connection with the cello? And when did you realize that it would enable you to travel and take others to unknown depths? Do you have like a special recall, a special moment when you said, that might be it.
I think it was really my first cello lesson when I got shown sort of the components of the instrument. And when, you know, I got to hold the bow for the first time and just to play like one open string, I was literally fascinated by the instrument. It was this sort of symbiotic, organic reaction. I never questioned it, or I never had a specific moment in time where I decided I want to play cello or I want to do this for the rest of my life. It just was this sort of organic journey. And I also could never envision myself doing anything else than other than music. I think deep down I always knew I wanted to pursue this path. And yes, it so happened that cello was the instrument that discovered me and that became my means of expression. Even though I would say that nowadays maybe I do consider myself first of all a musician and afterwards a cellist. I like to be surrounded by the world of music, but of course I wouldn't necessarily consider myself purely just a cellist. As in the sense of, you know, like the pure craft, the craft of playing the instrument. However, learning to play any type of instrument properly requires a lot of time, loads of patience. And yes, one, of course, need, let's say, a certain physical conformation in order to be able to play this instrument, or the ability to learn music fast, or there's, of course, the, you know, like the pure potential aspect of things, but nonetheless, the most important aspect was just working and working and having the patience to discover the instrument and to listen to yourself and to listen to the room while you're practicing, while you're performing. Playing any type of instrument requires a lot of attention to detail when talking about even the physiology of it, the positioning, the just the way every finger moves and in this sort of applied on the instrument, the way you use your natural weight, and so on and so forth. In a sense, I do encourage every parent to bring their kid into a music school if the children are musically talented and musically inclined as well, because it is sort of a way of self-discovery as well, because it is a lot of work that you basically have to do with yourself. Yes, it can feel lonely at times. Yes, it is time-consuming. But at the same time, it's such a great way for your own psychological discovery. On top of it, you consider the fact that you don't only prepare in order to play in your living room. One should prepare in order to perform in front of an audience. It is an act of love, you know, performing on stage, and this sort of sharing this product that you prepare for such a long time is also something quite special.
And you mentioning that an act of love and preparing something and sharing afterwards with someone else. Well, that's also cooking. And the next question is a question formulated by one of the most renowned pastry chefs in the world, also guest of us in this series, Scots, and he asks you.
Hello, my name is René Frank, and I would like to ask you, André, how does your gut feeling before a performance affect its result?
Well, back when I was still a student, or when I was still in a sort of learning process, I think the gut feeling did influence me a lot. If you let yourself be impacted by the surroundings, you always can get into danger of feeling a bit unsettled. And the moment you feel unsettled before going on stage, yes, you will be unsettled on stage as well. However, I would say that, and we were talking also about this sort of work on oneself and one's psyche. Before going on stage, yes, one has to listen to their own gut feeling, but also I assume we need this sort of almost blind confidence that whatever we're going to present on stage is just going to be the best version of ourselves. It's kind of an interesting because in a sense, yes, this is sort of a guttural effect because, well, when you're performing on stage, yes, you are basically naked. You know, your deepest thoughts, even the ones of the unconscious, do come through because you're not sort of completely in control anymore. You just have to present something that, in a sense, you know, you think about a sportsman as well. sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, right? Even though they had worked for hours and hours for that, and they'd repeated the same move or the same exercise for the same routine for a lot of times. However, that's the fascinating aspect about performing, is that one should also be able to sort of double themselves and have this sort of overlook from above while performing, in the sense of anticipating what's coming next, in the sense of always remembering yourself to breathe, to feel as grounded as possible, to find your center of gravity. And what I have to say, though, I think my gut feeling has followed me in a couple of, I'm going to say life decisions, but at least career decisions, or at least my gut feeling told me if something extraordinary was going to happen, my gut feeling would tell me that. Let's take even the Tchaikovsky competition. I was incredibly nervous for the whole sort of half a year preparation before going there. But also that's probably because my gut told me that something special was going to happen. And I always knew, be it, you know, in the worst imaginable way or in the best possible manner, I kind of knew that something out of the ordinary was going to happen. And I do remember, for example, during my second round there at the competition, I had played the first round and I tried to be sort of as controlled as possible. I tried to be the sort of the best student, you know, in front of the jury, and to show that I'm very well prepared and I'm as proper as possible, right? And then actually both of my teachers, both my Romanian teacher and my German teacher, they called me afterwards and they basically told me, you know, in the second round, you just give it your all. You just give it your like 1,000%. And that's exactly what happened. And I remember while I was performing the Shostakovich Sonata in St. Petersburg in his hometown, I just had this reaction. There's this sort of burst of energy and burst of tension, burst of emotions. And for the first time ever in my life, I started to tear up while performing. And this was, one of those really guttural moments that was sort of meant to happen and that I will never forget.
Tell us about this experience playing Shostakovich.
Talking about Shostakovich, yes, I had this fascination with him since my early teens, and I just connected with his very straightforward way of composing, which is also like deeply rooted into, of course, the historical context of the time. And the fact that, of course, there was lack of freedom and he was still deeply influenced by the events of the Second World War. So he was marred by all of these tragic events surrounding his time. And his music, yes, is deeply rooted in the tragic, but also there's lots of irony. There's lots of black comedy, which I always enjoyed. I am an Eastern European, I grew up in the 90s, which were, of course, times of freedom even there. But nonetheless, I would hear my grandparents' stories about the past. And there was this sort of grayish atmosphere around that whole area, even in this transitional period. And I still remember it. So, yeah, it's been a music that's naturally spoken to me for a long time. And as I said, it was just an honor to perform this music in its birthplace.
Were saying that you start like tearing apart. Were you also mesmerized?
This particular moment that I was mentioning before happened actually still in the middle of the competition. The competition is actually split into three rounds. So from the moment I finished my Shostakovich Sonata with piano back in the, actually in the chamber hall in St. Petersburg, chamber hall of the Philharmonic there, I knew that some sort of special moment was being created. And well, I even had a couple of jury members come up to me and hug me, which I don't think they were allowed to do. Anyway, from that point on, I didn't even matter about the results anymore. Or yes, I did get, I did to pass further to the finals. But in the finals, I just wanted to sort of enjoy the moment. You know, the final round, which is always a concerto with orchestra. In our case, it was two concertos. with the Rococo variations, and on top of it, a concerto of our own choice. And of course, I wanted to play Shostakovich. That final run was basically just cherry on top. And no matter what result was going to happen, I knew I enjoyed my time there under, you know, sort of the biggest spotlight in our field, considering the fact that, the competition was live streamed and, you know, millions of people were watching it.
This was a pivotal moment in your career. I have to say that the way that you play Shostakovich, the orchestra, Alexeyev, the audience, and I could bet Shostakovich himself, if we could bring him back to life, you swept everybody away.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
Andrei, we just heard the excerpt of Shostakovich's Cello Concert No. 1 in E flat major, Opus 107, which you were mentioning that you played with Orchestra of Shostakovich State Academy in St. Petersburg Philharmonic, conducted by Nikolai Alexeyev. And you were talking about playing this during the 15th Tchaikovsky competition in the last round. We've been talking a lot about the incorporeal part of the cello, but let's top for a moment and get down to the physical part. Continuing with guts, traditionally the cello strings were made from sheep or goat gut, valued for their warmth and complex sound. Gut strings, however, are sensitive to humidity and temperature changes, require more maintenance than modern synthetic or steel strings. Despite this, some musicians still prefer gut strings for their unique tonal qualities. So, Andrei, gut strings or modern synthetic or steel strings? And then why?
Yeah, probably for historically accurate performances, especially when we're talking about old music, baroque music and so on, I assume gut strings would be indeed the most fitted. I do know very accomplished performers who still use gut strings even on the modern instruments and in order to perform, you know, sort of more modern music. One of my favorite cellists, English cellist, Stephen Isserlis, he does perform every single concert only using gut strings. And yes, the warmth of color that sort of really like organic string produces is really not comparable to anything else. However, the concert halls have been getting bigger and bigger. And one of the biggest needs of a soloist is that to be able to project. Even singers, for example, had to change their technique over the years in order to project in theaters and in halls over 2,000 seats. So from this perspective, yes, the steel strings are definitely the most suited, especially for any kind of big event and big ambience. But I myself have only tried, I think, once for fun to perform on gut strings. But however, I started performing and I started learning the instrument on steel strings. At least for the near future, I will keep on performing on them.
Physically speaking, the bow strokes of the cello can strengthen the muscles of the upper body, which makes me think about how playing can help to develop good posture.
If done properly.
Exactly. In the sense that, well, you need to harmonize the alignment of your body with the position of the cello against your midsection to ensure a graceful and sustained performance. So could you describe for us the right position required for playing the cello? And I'd love to know if this posture and positioning of the cello impacts your gut health and overall well-being in any way.
Mm. One of the things I like about cello is the fact that it does provide one of the most natural positions from all the instruments. I don't think I would ever feel comfortable just holding the violin, you know. It does create kind of a twisted position of the back, of the arms and so on. The ideal position on the cello would be that we are able to still keep our center of gravity as low as possible and just have a sort of a straight back. So I think shoulders down is one of the most important aspects. This comes, however, also with the process of breathing. Because the moment one concentrates on a lot of things, because in an instrument playing does require a lot of distributive attention as well, because left hand doing one thing, right hand doing completely a different thing. On top of it, you have to think about not just about the physical aspect of it, but about music making and dynamics and so on and so forth. But however, the most important aspect is being able to breathe. And that's what I always try to tell my students, especially if I'm in a master class and, you know, they come and play to me for the first time. The most important aspect is being able to breathe in, of course. We need that for concentration, but also to breathe out into the music.
And I was thinking the other day, and we're talking about the gut and the cello right now, and I thought one could draw a metaphorical parallel between the precision and control required by the cellist and the digestive system. Just as the cellist must manipulate the bow skillfully to produce beautiful music, the digestive system must precisely control and efficiently process enzymes to break down food. It is about balance. So we talked before about how playing the cello can help to have a good posture, but now I'm interested. Do you do any specific exercises, apart from the breathing techniques that you were mentioning, to release muscle tension? Or perhaps there's even a diet or something you eat or drink in preparation for a concert or after a concert?
Yeah, well, I should probably have a more, lead a more healthy or sustainable diet. But the most important aspect, like, you are actually exercising even while you are practicing. As long as you're able to practice in a relaxed way and always keep your muscles as relaxed as possible and use your natural weight, as I was mentioning, while performing. You know, for beautiful cello playing, you kind of need to have this sort of meaty approach. For example, even when you're talking about the left hand that moves on the fingerboard, it's hard to play if your fingers sort of kind of almost touching by the nails, the strings, you know. You just have to use your pillows of the fingers, you know, just like this upper part of the finger. And just to be able to press sort of with a meaty touch on the string, we always try to strive for this sort of instrumental approach. It's going to work out long-term as well. No back problems, I guarantee, and no future sore muscles and so on. Of course, yes, I start to do, stretching, you know, after, let's say, a very intense session of practicing or after a concert or before a concert or after the general rehearsal with the orchestra when I still have to sort of relax my arms, relax my hands, relax my fingers before the big concert in the evening. This is also something we must do. But I think the most important aspect is how you practice and how you're sort of, you manage to connect mind and the body at the same time.
So this is one of my favorite pieces of your CD, Oblique Strategies, which is Black Run, composed by Svante Henriksen. It sounds like country music, and at the same time, it is modern, and it is filled with so much color and emotions. And I would even dare to say that there's a lot of dark humor, too. So we talked earlier at the beginning about imaging, and I would like to ask you, to transport yourself into your interpretation. And with this in mind, what does the embrace of the bow against the strings feel like?
Yeah, so this piece, Black Run by Svante Henriksen, is basically meant as the anchor of the whole CD. It's also the last track. It's just a cheeky note to all the work that I had put before that. And it's just about having a bit of fun with the music. Even, of course, it's also technically demanding. And even for that, I had to learn some new effects. To me, this piece is just sort of this burst of positive energy and just sort of explosion of colors. It gets into country music, into groovy, rocky feelings. There's even a bit of klezmer in there. And it just shows you the capacity of the instrument to also sort of cross over. Yes, I'm a purist when it comes to classical music. And I do feel that this is like the fingerprint of our society and our culture and our civilization and so on. But yeah, I guess we're also allowed once in a while to have a tiny bit of fun.
When you, at least myself, and speaking for myself, watch how the movement and pressure of a cellist bow goes across the strings, and at least it looks like this for me, it is like it would gently soothe and stimulate the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that holding the bow against the strings so close to the gut affects the gut, emotionally speaking?
Well, because you're actually holding the instrument so close, and because of the position, it's kind of close to your body. You have to touch it between your legs, between your knees, and also there's this other point, which is actually right under the sternum. You basically feel the vibrations of the instrument. And yes, you do feel the vibrations throughout your whole body. The other thing is that the cello is connected to the earth and is connected to the ground. And yes, it does sort of bring you back to the earth, which is one of the aspects I really enjoy about it.
I'm beginning to think of the cello as a living entity. He could be being interviewed right now also.
Yeah, I'm always asked like, oh, does she have a name?
And does she?
No.
No?
No.
And I have to say its size and shape and the fact that it sounds so close to the human voice, that makes it an incredible sensual instrument. And in addition to this, there's the tactile element that you were also talking about before. It is a really powerful instrument, emotionally and physically speaking. And I think it requires a lot of intimacy. And if you think about it, in the one hand, it imitates the human soul. But on the other hand, it's so earthy as sexuality. It's so tender and brutal, just like the many colors of its tones, I would say. So just to see how the player holds the cello against his torso, I mean, it's like a dance between the musician's body and the instrument. And this is a slight different question as a question I asked you before, so you have to listen carefully. In what ways does the physical sensation of the cello resting against your abdomen influences your emotional expression and the depth of sounds you produce, particularly during these intense low passages?
Not sure I've consciously thought about this. What I would say is that, yes, I always enjoy performing like on this sort of grungy C string, and actually, there's a lot of passages in the back suites where one has to access this register. And yeah, this is really the beauty of the instrument, the fact that we can sing as high as a soprano and still play as sensually, in a sensually low register, just as the bass with the biggest harmonics.
Because it sounds like a dialogue. You were talking about these vibrations in the sternum, and it's kind of having a dialogue directly with the gut.
Well, I'll keep in mind actually feeling these vibrations in during my next performance. It's probably something that kind of happens in the unconscious and you just have to sort of access it without even being
like to be more being aware of that.
Yes.
So let's talk about the Balkans. When Balkan musicians play string instruments such as the violin and of course the cello, the music they produce is music of great depth. The kind of depth that touches the innermost fibers. It's as if the bow would act as a metaphorical dagger that goes from the heart to the guts to tell the listener, look, this is what mortality feels like. It is a kind of mixture of aliveness and nostalgia, of joy and sadness at the same time. Andre, tell us about Bucharest and how Romania speaks through your bow.
Romania is kind of an interesting geographical place in Europe because, well, we're not the center of the world, but from a pure historical and geographical perspective, we are at a crossroads of many influences. we've always been part of sort of Eastern Europe. We've been, living under lots of Turkish influence during the Middle Ages and, of course, afterwards the Soviet. However, we always wanted to belong to the Western circles of influence. We are Francophone and Francophile. This sort of interesting mixture, and Romanians are kind of like a sponge, I would say. We just absorb all these sort of influences from all the surroundings and all the neighboring areas, and then sort of mix it, blend it through our own lens. I would say Romanian spirituality is a lot rooted in this sort of general nostalgia, or this sort of a search for a lost, almost mythical time, land, or just basically universal feeling of being connected to the universe. And George Ionescu, our beloved and most recognized Romanian musical figure, was always talking about the concept, a Romanian concept of dor. This Romanian word basically describes this sort of general nostalgia. And it's hurting a bit, but also you're kind of at peace with it. And this sort of spirituality is something that is very fascinating about, I think, about Romanian people. You know, we have one of the most famous folk poems, folk ballads, is just telling a story about a shepherd whose sheep actually told him that these other envious shepherds were planning to kill him. And his response actually was that he sort of accepted his destiny and just asked the sheep to tell his mom that he had married this princess of the nature of the forest, and basically that he sort of reconnected in a very deep level, on deep level and spiritual level, with the nature just by re-becoming part of it. And there's something interesting about having this sort of light sadness, but also sort of being at peace with it, that always fascinated me with Romanian people. And I guess there's a sort of a universal aspect of it, also being able to express all ranges of emotions, sorrow, and the biggest joy, and, you know, being both introvert and extrovert is very interesting about at least my nation, the way I perceive it. I don't necessarily consider myself a completely extrovert person, but yes, the moment I hold the instrument in my hands, then I kind of do become a different person than maybe in real life.
You know, this story about the ship and then making peace with his destiny, in the way, well, in that way, nostalgic and sad destiny. And in a way, also, you're talking about this Tchaikovsky's competition, knowing that it was your destiny and feeling called to perform there, and that you knew that was something like perhaps written in the stars that you had to perform there, that kind of calling. That also happened to Julius Caesar, for example, in his last battle. He had all the bad omens there, but he still had to make peace with his destiny and said, I'll do it anyways. And he won the battle, but then you know what happened in the Senate. So we've talked about right now about spirituality and nostalgia, and before the cello being able to sound like the human voice, and its ability to produce an enormous variety of colors. As you mentioned before, it can play as a double bass, and at the same, it matches instruments like the violin in higher registers. And also how it allows the cellist a very wide range as far as emotional potential. And this means also sadness and sorrow. We will hear an excerpt of On Darkness from Barbara Holmes' book, Race and the Cosmos, in which she refers to the beauty of darkness. She's a spiritual teacher, activist, and scholar focused on African-American spirituality, mysticism, cosmology, and culture. So let's hear.
In the beginning, there is darkness. It is the womb out of which we are born. Darkness may be the blessed dimming of ego-driven striving, a destination and condition of safety and repose. In this state of trusting refuge, the light of divine revelation, which pierces but does not castigate the darkness, may finally be seen. This is a mothering darkness, that nurses its offspring.
So the cello can particularly be beautiful and elegant in minor keys, often evoking deepness, the kind of the depth of the mothering darkness, which Barbara Holmes speaks about. Andre, that was you performing with the Philharmonica Georgianescu.
Right,
in a live concert on the 7th of October in 2020.
Oh, yeah, in front of an empty hall. Yeah, I remember.
For you, as a cellist, why is the sadness and sorrow so elegantly evoked by the cello? So inviting.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about that particular performance, it was, you know, during the pandemic times, and we had just got the news one day before the concert that the state wouldn't allow public anymore in that particular hall. It's really just a moment when the sort of the music scene was just about to open up, and then everything came crashing down last minute again. So we still decided to perform a live stream concert in this empty Athenaeum, which is actually the Romanian Temple of Music. It's a wonderful hall. So that particular performance, yes, I felt the sort of helplessness of also of our field and in relation to the big society. You know, there's also this sort of, if you're talking about registers and how they are connected to feelings, yes, I guess the lower registers somehow tend to be associated with, you know, with emotional depth. The most organic and usually the most natural way to phrase, especially if the composer hasn't written in specific dynamics or specific dynamic intentions, is really just to follow the line. And usually the line, when the line goes down, the mood also goes down. So I guess it's sort of this organic aspect of the lower register sort of being connected to more depth, to being sometimes sorrow. And in other times, it can also be incredibly powerful.
What an amazing instrument, and how incredibly it has come a long way from its origins as a simple dance instrument to becoming a symbol of courage and defiance. And think of Jacqueline Dupré. She played the Elgar Cello Concerto with passion despite her illness. She took the listeners on a beautiful, deep journey showing the power of the human spirit. And then you also mentioned before Pablo Casals, how he left Spain to protest against Franco, and how he played the Song of the Birds at the White House for President John F. Kennedy. What a star. He used his struggles to give a beautiful performance that people around the world loved and understood. And then Yo-Yo Ma, after the 9/11 attacks, his performance of Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 was incredible. He transformed sorrow into beauty and reflection. And although people were, of course, sad to the deepest roots, his music offered comfort. And it showed the cello's ability to express strong feelings to its best. Andre, has the cello also given you the chance to become more resilient in life or offered you comfort in difficult times?
My relationship with cello has sort of evolved over the years because, yes, when I was really learning it and discovering it and I was trying to master it, it really became my whole life. Of course, I had the care of school. Actually, my schedule was almost busier back when I was in high school because, you know, you had 7 hours of classes plus homeworks, and I didn't go to regular musical high school. I went to theoretical high school while still studying with my cello professor. It was very interesting because I never felt tired at the time, because like school, regular school, and learning aspect of music and the instrument were sort of like balancing each other out. My mind was also sort of focusing on so many different aspects that it was actually in a way less tiring than just like, you know, when I came to Berlin just to study music and just to focus on this one particular thing. I think performing and learning cello has taught me a lot of discipline, of course. I think this is the biggest takeaway actually of learning to play an instrument, because it is both something that accesses the conscious and the unconscious, the objective and the subjective. And you require a lot of discipline, you require a lot of thinking. But also, yes, when talking about music making, using your instinct and just being connected to your body in order to perform in a consciously relaxed way. If we're talking about social engagement...
I'm talking about you. Have the cello offered you comfort, you, in difficult times? Let's say something that had made you very sad and you could play cello. Because I could imagine myself if I could play well, playing cello and suiting myself.
Funny thing was that I actually did this on the piano. Yeah, if I just feel the need to sort of detach, I would just take up, you know, some, just a random piece of music or something that is, you know, either in my library or I would just like download it. And then I would try to read, just like sight read some music on the piano, because piano, you know, does provide sort of the bigger harmonic range and so on. So you kind of get a bigger picture right away. But what I would say is that listening to music and listening, of course, to, let's say, my childhood cello heroes, it always provided comfort and it always inspired me. And mentioning Jacqueline Dupré and mentioning Steven Easterlitz and also Daniel Shafrandis were the people that I aspired to, not necessarily to emulate, but to have this strength of character.
Has there ever been a time when you've given comfort to someone individually, a friend or someone, an audience, through your music?
Well, I did have people come up to me, you know, just with tears in their eyes after a concert. And I guess that's the most rewarding thing for an artist. But for that, I'd rather have the audience decide.
If you were friends with me, you know, I would come to you and say, Andre, could you play something? Just play something.
Yes,
and then
yes, definitely.
So Roman soldiers evoked the idea of courage due to their legendary discipline, loyalty, and fearlessness in battle. And they were trained to face overwhelming odds and maintain formation even under the most extreme conditions. Their willingness to fight for the glory of Rome, often to the point of sacrificing their lives, symbolizes a timeless form of bravery that has been admired throughout history. In This Is on Guts, we have, of course, talked about having guts, about having courage. In an interview with historian and author Philip Matyshak, an expert in ancient history, and whose excerpt we are about to hear, we spoke about the Roman soldiers' courage in the battlefield and the real reason why they could not break.
So one of the things that is drilled into every Roman before a battle is do not break. The Romans win their battles by brute force, but that isn't just brute force as in a barbarian who charges in screaming and swinging his sword. This is a highly disciplined group of men who work as a single machine. And the trouble with that machine is, if it breaks, if one person or two people leave the ranks, the whole thing falls to pieces. And the Romans know this. They know if they keep going forward, if they stay shoulder to shoulder, they're unbeatable. If they break, they're dead. The Romans had a punishment called decimation, which meant if a unit broke in combat, then the survivors would be gathered up and the commander would pronounce sentence of decimation. There would then be a lottery, and one in every 10 people in that unit would get a short straw, which meant he was going to be killed. And here's the really nasty bit. He wasn't killed by the commander or by his executioners. He was ordered to be killed by the other men in his squad. So these people have to go to their tent mates, to the people they had beers with, and they've got to kill them. Can you imagine the psychological effect of this? First, you've got the shame of running in combat, and the result is the scorn of the rest of the army. Then you've got the guilt that you've had to kill your own friends. Now, can you imagine the feelings of the people who have suffered through this? You'd rather not break, but can you also imagine next time they go into battle, they've got an awful lot to get off their chest, and they will fight like suicidal maniacs, just like the gladiator does, because that's the path to redemption, through virtus.
We have just heard why a Roman soldier's breaking on the battlefield would kill not only the one who broke for breaking a military unit, but all the other members of his unit, morally and spiritually speaking, who would have to kill the one that lost the lottery. And you would ask, what does this has to do with me? Andre, when you play, whether Bach or newer compositions, such as the ones by Svante Henriksen, you bring sincerity to every note. And sometimes you do something that I find very courageous. You break. What I mean is, when playing, there are times that when you reach the highest mark, you then soon after let go. I think this is a surrender act and an act of absolute courage, since that moment demands 100% vulnerability of your part. It's like a sudden death, and not everybody's able to accept that kind of vulnerability and embrace it so beautifully and elegant as you do. In a way, we're taught not to break. But you, by breaking, you provide us, the audience, just as the Roman soldier did to their peers by not breaking, a redemptive path to glory. And my question now, you know what I meant, right? Are you conscious?
I hope so.
Are you conscious about that reaching the higher note and then letting go and how this feels for the audience? Are you aware of the effect that you have on the listeners when you do this?
Well, I would go back to the needed range, emotional range that one needs in order to perform. So performing any work, be it probably a dancer, be it an actor, be it a musician, requires a bit of the acting aspect of it, but also intertwining it with your own interpretation, with your own vision, with your own emotions. And it does require, of course, a great emotional range. Sometimes you might come to a climax and actually still not give it your all because you have another big climax coming up towards the end of the piece. And yes, a big climax is also, of course, a heroical like gesture. And after a heroical gesture, sometimes you might get to the biggest of deaths. Of course, if we're talking about like the purely objective aspect of, you know, analyzing a work and basing and everything, yes, it is a conscious process. But probably, you know, at the end of the day, something like the microphrasing and actually like just the connection between every single note is something that does have to come from the heart and does. And that's something that even the performers themselves are not necessarily, I wouldn't say in control of, but in a very spiritual way, not necessarily aware of. And this is the beauty of music making, just the fact that, yes, I can explain to you, for example, on a purely objective level, how to create a beautiful sound. But why does that beautiful sound impact my emotional state? I do not have an answer for that.
Let's leave it in mystery.
Exactly.
Because if your listeners are sensitive enough, I think, and I'm sure they would feel the effect directly, spot on in the heart and in the gut.
This is why I enjoy being a performing musician, because, well, I might be biased, of course, but music does have, even more so than many other arts, just the ability to cut straight to the soul. In just one of these really instinctive, guttural ways.
That's a Romanian dagger.
There we go.
Andre, this was you with clarinetist Pablo Barragán and pianist Juan Pérez Floristan from your joint CD Brahms Complete Clarinet Sonatas and Trio. A fantastic CD that I absolutely recommend. And as Beethoven said, to play a wrong note is insignificant. To play without passion is inexcusable. And he was so right. What is life without passion? Now tell me, who do you admire the most for being courageous and for having the guts to live life to the fullest?
Ooh, I don't know if I've ever really had like big role models talking about it, just like life in general. I did have role models talking about music. And somebody, of course, like Jacqueline Dupré, you know, who had a sort of expansive personality on and off stage, were people that really inspired me.
In your personal life?
In my personal life, you know, I really was deeply inspired by my mom for her courage. So I lost my father when I was one. You know, I don't want to make it necessarily a sob story. But yeah, my mom, she just decided from that point on to dedicate herself to basically raising me and educating me. And she sacrificed everything for that. She was a single mom. And I also really want to thank her for letting me go. First of all, she was the one who brought me into the world of music. She brought me into the music school for the first time because she noticed my musical potential from a very early age. However, it was a big step for her to also let me pursue this career and go abroad. Well, I didn't go abroad because I wanted to leave Romania. I wanted to go to a place suited for my field, which, you know, on the European musical scene, it is Berlin because it has the biggest musical scene. We're talking about like 7 or 8 professional orchestras on top of, you know, 3 great music universities. And it's sort of this hotspot where everybody meets, everybody even manages, you know, gets to network and so on. And I just wanted to be here and to belong here. And for her, you know, to let me go was a really hard step. And I think this was a big act of courage actually from her part as well.
Andre, we have reached our final destination, and I would like to thank you for your sincerity and the incredible music journey you have given us into the heart of music, into your world as a cellist, as a musician, and most of all, as a human being. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. To follow Andre's Ionitsa steps, especially his orchestral highlights of this 24-25 season, which include performances with the orchestra Sinfonía Radio Televisión Española, RTVE, in Madrid, the Saarland State Orchestra and the San Luis Symphony Orchestra, both conducted by Ruth Reinhardt, and 5 concert tour with the Moravian Philharmonic Orchestra, Olomouc. Don't forget to check out this episode's description or follow him on social media. His Instagram account is Ionitsa, then use the underscore sign followed by Andre94. Also, all of Andre's CDs are available on Spotify, Apple Music, and the platform of your choice. See you next time. Bye-bye. Bye.